Dan Walters, I think probably one of the most prolific and preeminent political commentators for California policy and politics. You've been at it for 40 years.
I've been in the newspaper business for 50, or I say the newspaper business, technically I'm no longer in the newspaper business, yeah. But 57 years.
Yeah.
And I've been writing a column for 40 years and a daily column for the Sacramento Union, the Sacramento Bee, and now for CalMatters.org, basically the same column. Since 1981. So what are we talking about? Do the arithmetic. What is it?
37 years. In that time, you have you've been unafraid to sort of tell it like it is, or at least how you see it. On some of the big heavy hitters here in the state of California, you are no stranger to taking on the unions when you think that they when you want to speak your mind on them. You're no stranger to taking on hot topics like pensions. You just sort of go for it and let the chips fall where may.
Don't you? if you're going to do it, you have to do it. I think it's difficult, I think, for some journalists to make that transition from reporter to columnist, analyst, commentator, whatever you want, whatever, because you have to be willing to have a conclusion, to say something that's you know, that may not set right with a lot of people, rather than doing a he said, she said, you know, sort of thing. You have to actually say, no, I say, basically. And that's difficult.
That takes some getting used to.
It's a difficult transition. I know a lot of very good reporters who have never been able to make that transition. They just can't quite get to that point of saying, well, really what this really is, you know, it ought to be blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And so take a little bit of self-confidence or sort of
ego, foolhardiness, take your pick.
Okay. Very cool. Yeah, you know, it's something, I know exactly what you're talking about, because in this median here, I try to get out of the way of my guests and just sort of give them a platform to, one, share their stories, share their successes, but also their failures, because I think that's kind of interesting too. But I've been a little bit reluctant to sort of like inject myself in there in terms of like you really using this as a platform to air my own views and beliefs. Mostly because I think of what you talked a little bit is sort of like, well, I wouldn't want it to be held against me, or I wouldn't, you know.
Sometimes I'll write something. I'll write something about somebody, particularly a politician, and they'll say, "You're not being fair to me." And I'll say, "I don't get paid to be fair to you. I get paid to." Be critical or analytic or something, but that's not what I do. That's a whole different game, and you just have to be willing to accept that for what it is. And I had a taste.
Would you say that you're pretty critical a lot? I think that's okay. But it, you know, if I sort of like read through your headlines, I feel like critical is like an angle that you come at a lot, right? Is that just sort of like you have concerns generally about how the state is being run? Do you have concerns generally on the fiscal side? Do you have like a, I mean, I, in a way, I'm almost kind of asking you if you're like a Republican or like a declined a little bit more fiscally conservative than you would like to see the state being run? Because it seems to be sort of like the same themes of like of spending and sort of budgeting that you tend to be critical
of. I guess if I have a philosophy of government, it's something like this, that government ought to do what it needs to do, right? It needs to have highways. It needs to run a school system and so forth. It should do what it needs to do, and it should do it well. Okay. And rather than trying to do a lot of things poorly, it should do its fundamental functions well.
Okay.
And I think when we talk about particularly government services and budgets and that sort of thing, there's a tendency to leave out the equation of, is it working well? Because we say, well, they put the money into this, or we do this. Oh, I've done a great job. I've appropriated money for XYZ. But do we ever go back and say, well, do we really need XYZ? And if we do, how's it going on? I mean, we saw a real world example of that very recently, and that is the near collapse of Oroville Dam, the highest dam in America, which would have absolutely devastated downstream communities had it given way, and it came very close to doing so. And we know now, because of forensic studies that have been made, that the dam was poorly designed, poorly constructed, and poorly maintained.
Okay.
And it didn't stop when we built that dam. There had to be...
It's an ongoing commitment.
It's an ongoing thing. And we see that same kind of, I would even call it lackadaisical attitude when in highways. I mean, here's we have a state of California whose motorists are paying the highest gasoline taxes in the country. Okay. The highest. And we have, by judgment, not my judgment, but by the Federal Highway Administration judgment, the second worst pavement conditions of any state, and the worst traffic congestion of any state. So you have to say, what's up? And I can attest, I have driven in every state in the United States, with the exception of Alaska, in the last 20 years. And I will tell you, from my own experience, yeah, we got crappy roads. In fact, the governor says we have crappy roads. Why did it take so long for somebody to get to wake up to that and start to do a little bit on it? It's something that should have been done right along, just as Oroville Dam should have been maintained. They had plenty of warning that this thing was flawed and could collapse under certain circumstances, and it was basically covered up. And so it's one thing to say, well, we should spend money, or we should tax money, we should spend money. We should also say, how is that money being spent? Is it being spent on something that's really needed, number one, or is it being dissipated among a whole bunch of things that we don't need, and we're really neglecting the things we do need? Mm-hmm. That's the sort of thing that irritates me. And I say, I go back to my policy. Policy is government should do the things it needs to do, and it should do them well. It shouldn't try to stretch itself too thin to try to do everything for everybody and do them poorly. Okay. Now, a 12-cent gas tax bite plus some other fees is a pretty good chunk, no question about it. That said, we probably should have been raising that gas tax a penny a year
for the last 12 years,
for a long time, rather than doing it all as one chunk. And we even more so, we should have devised an entirely new system of taxing for roads. Look, here are the data on highways in California. We drive about 330 billion miles a year in California. That's about almost a billion miles a day. A billion miles a day. That's a lot.
Yeah.
And we consume about 15 billion gallons of fuel every year. That mileage has doubled over the last 30 years. The amount of fuel that we think has gone up by a very small amount. Why? Because cars are much more efficient now than they were once upon a time. So a long time, and this has been known for a long time, that the gas tax that it's applied to gallonage didn't really match the reality of having better fuel economy and so forth. So we were actually collecting less per mile of roadway than we should have been doing.
Yeah.
So we should have had a different system of doing it, you know, a system based on mileage or some other system.
You're okay with a mileage-based system?
What's that?
You're okay with a mileage-based system?
I'd be okay with it if we can figure out how to not, and I think we can, avoid privacy invasion in some kind. In other words, a fair and system that doesn't have Big Brother tracking every car everywhere they're going. Right. I can live with it, because that makes more sense. It really does make more. It also picks up all those people in electric cars and whatnot that otherwise kind of escape the gas taxes. Although this new plan does get a little bit of money out of them, it really doesn't really do what needs to be done. The more you use, the more you pay. It's as simple as that. Other forms of government finance are not necessarily the same. There's no relationship between what you pay and what you use. But there is with gas taxes or certain other kinds of fee. I mean, like a state park admission fee, the more you use, the more you pay.
Right.
And that sort of thing. And that's a perfectly reasonable way to finance certain kinds of government services that are kind of isolated. Now, not everybody goes to a state park, and not everybody drives on the roads. So it actually is fairer than trying to do it out of general revenues. If anything, we've become too far away from that user pays thing. We've run bond measures, a big one back about 10 years or so ago, to finance highways coming out of general revenues. I think that was wrong to do it then. And Jerry Brown finally said it was wrong and started paying off that bond with user fees, which is the right thing to do. But it depends on the activity. But activities that are essentially done by user demand, like the use of roads, should be financed by user fees.
Okay.
Kind or another.
Okay. You were talking, we got started on this because you were talking about sort of government's core responsibilities and not doing things that don't need to be done, right?
So and doing the things that needs to be done well.
Well, right. What are we doing that doesn't need to be done in your view? I just wanted to ask you a bunch of questions because I'm interested in your views. So
there's a tendency in government to every time there's a something happens, natural disaster or an economic downturn, to want to be to tell the voters, oh, we're doing something about it.
Right.
And so somebody rushes in and does something about it, and they pass some new law or some new program or some new service. So, but it's more of a kind of a casual swipe at the issue rather than a genuine solution to a problem. And these things tend to pile up over time. I think I counted up one time, the state had something like 19 or 20 different economic development programs. Because every time the economy would go down, they say, oh, we have to have an economic development program. So they pass a new one, but they have never repealed an old one. Some of them finally got repealed. The enterprise zones got repealed, for example. Redevelopment got repealed, for example. And I give Jerry Brown credit for that. He said, this is ridiculous. These don't make do any good. Now, he's put in a few of his own, like tax subsidies for motion pictures that are very questionable. So, I mean, his hands aren't particularly clean.
I mean, that's not just him. I feel like the South, you know, the LA area members had a lot to do with pushing that into the...
That may be, but it's still bad policy. It's bad government policy to pick out one industry and decide you're going to give a state subsidy to it only because it's a glamour industry that has that politicians like to associate themselves with. Why should the state subsidize motion picture production in California and say not agriculture or making something else? I mean, we do, and it's not the only one that gets subsidized.
We subsidize agriculture.
We subsidize, to a certain extent, we subsidize agriculture through water, and we subsidize electric cars and through subsidies and that sort of thing. But that's a dangerous practice. You're trying to pick winners, and by definition, then not pick what you would consider to be losers. It becomes a kind of a statist sort of way of looking at the economy rather than let the economy do what it does, which is to, you know, function. The winners are win because they win and the losers lose because they lose. And and it doesn't really have much real economic impact. The motion picture industry, as visible as it is a tiny, tiny part of the Southern California economy. Now, it happens to be connect with a lot of people in the motion picture industry who have political influence because they're glamorous figures or that sort of thing. But as far as an economic institution, the motion picture industry in Southern California is minuscule. It's tiny. And there's no rational reason why we should try to prop that one up and let others wither on the vine if, in fact, they wither on the vine.
Okay. What are we doing well?
If
your answer is nothing, that's okay too.
I think we do certain things well. I this is going to shock everybody, but I think the Department of Motor Vehicles works very well. I've had many experiences with them. I happen to own a lot of boats at one time, so I would seem like I was at the DMV office all the time.
You're a Delta guy?
I had 7 boats at one time. Now I'm down to 1, and I'm probably going to sell it. But so I was doing a lot of interaction between boats and trailers. I was doing a lot of interaction with the Department of Motor Vehicles. I've always found them to be very efficient, and if you follow the right and you make the appointments and you do the thing, it works out just fine. I have no problem. I think the Department of Motor Vehicles work, and that's really the one that most people seem to hate because they mostly hate it because they don't do it right, and then they get frustrated. But I think it works extremely well. I think that our police services, like the Highway Patrol, are fine. They're a first-class agency. I think the firefighters' agencies do a very good job. I think we do well on that sort of thing. We don't do well when we try to get into the weeds and get past these kind of basics and start trying to do these kind of esoteric sorts of things like prop up the motion picture industry. And it's particularly we don't do well when we try to finagle with the tax policy and try to give people tax loopholes and everything. It doesn't really, it never works out well when you do that. What you wind up doing is creating a kind of a crony capitalist system where mm-hmm. those with political pull get subsidies and tax breaks and that sort of thing. And that's all tax breaks are, subsidies. And everybody else can go pound sand. Now, I'll give you an example. An example was put into law about 30 years ago. If you go to Fry's and you want to buy a software program, Tax Cutter or TurboTax or Windows or something, you get that and you'll get it in a box and it has a disc and you will pay a sales tax on that. All right?
Right.
If you're a multi-million dollar company and you order up a custom software program from PeopleSoft or somebody like that, and it might cost you $2 million, you don't pay any sales tax on it. Why? Because the custom software industry got themselves a sales tax break 30-some-odd years ago. It makes absolutely no sense in the world. There's no reason why they should get a tax break, and the ordinary consumer doesn't on that sort of thing. If software shouldn't be taxed, it shouldn't be taxed. If it is, should be taxed, it should be taxed. But that's the sort of thing that goes on and on. And then we have these great inanities in the tax code. Hot food is subject to sales tax. Cold food isn't.
Not, yeah.
So you go to Subway and you order a cold sandwich, you don't pay sales tax on it. If you order a hot sandwich, you have to pay sales tax on it. Does that make any sense? Absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. But we seem to let these inanities in the tax code build up year after year after year, and there's no session of the legislature is complete without at least one effort to punch a new loophole for somebody in there. And to show you how inane that hot food, cold food, the motion picture industry actually went to the State Board of Equalization and argued that popcorn sold in the theater
was cold.
Might be hot, but by the time it got to the seat, it was cold, therefore it shouldn't be taxed. You know, that's the sort of stupidity we encounter. I just think that government ought to be straightforward. They ought to treat the tax system ought to be rational. A rational tax, that's another thing, by the way, we don't do very well. A rational tax system has a broad, whether it's a sales tax or an income tax or any kind of other tax, a good tax system has a broad base and a low rate. California has a narrow base on all of its tax systems and high rates. Mm-hmm. The reason we have such high rates is we have such a narrow base. You know, like 150,000 taxpayers in a state of 39 plus million pay half of the state income taxes. That's mm-hmm. the very definition of a narrow base and a high rate. Whereas,
is that not reflected roughly proportionally in the federal level?
No, it's much more pronounced than at the federal level.
Yeah.
Much more pronounced. And our tax system in California is much more, quote, progressive, unquote, although I don't think it's very progressive, than it is at the federal level. And so it means that the entire state budget of California, schools, prisons, all the stuff that people take for granted, are totally dependent upon a handful of wealthy people and their willingness to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's dangerous because not only because they could move away, which they could, and some have, but because their incomes are very volatile because they're dependent largely on stocks and other capital markets.
Right. They're not drawing down salaries at that level.
No, they are drawing salaries, but it's much of their incomes come from capital gains.
Right.
Capital gains are voluntary. You don't have to take them unless you sell the underlying capital. And they're very volatile. Back in the last recession, the state saw a 20% decrease in its revenues. Virtually all of that 20% decrease was from those high-end taxpayers. You know, you don't have to feel sorry for these people. You know, it's $10 million one year, $5 million the next. So what? They're not starving to death. But as a revenue source, it picks the state dangerously dependent on that. And so when you get a very small downturn in the economy, you can see a huge downturn in state revenues. And then we're in one of these our periodic budget crises. By Jerry Brown's own bean counters, if we had a mild recession going forth, a mild recession would cost the state $20 billion a year mm-hmm. in lost revenue, or about at 60 to 70 billion over 3 years. That's dangerous. That means all the stuff that's dependent on that, colleges, K-12 education, health and welfare programs, prisons, everything would take a beating, as it did when we had a severe recession a decade ago. And so it's stupid to let that system go on year after year. You're just playing with fire, and it becomes even more pronounced the further you get into it. But Jerry Brown will go out of office with the state even more dependent on those rich people than when he took office because of the, quote, temporary, unquote, tax that he sponsored in 2012 and that was then was made semi-permanent in 2016. Going forward, he could be leaving an enormous problem for his successor. And he knows it. He's talked about it. But he's not willing to undertake the kind of heavy lifting that tax reform would take.
Well, at first, you know, if you're going to broaden that base, you're going to shift some of that burden downstream, right, to middle and lower income taxpayers.
Yes, you would.
I mean, I think there's some reluctance to do that, right?
There is a lot of reluctance to do it, which is why it's not been done.
Yeah.
But we've now trapped ourselves.
You know, you'd say, I mean, you,
we're trapped ourselves.
You're lowering taxes on the rich to, you know, to increase it on the poor. It's like Robin Hood, but in advance, but in reverse.
Okay, but right? It's those same people who are dependent upon those services that those taxes support.
Okay.
And so it's there is no free lunch in this world, and you make the tax system more volatile and more less dependable. At the same time, the expenditure side of the state's ledger has become ever more locked in by constitutional amendment, so it becomes very difficult to make those kind of adjustments. When you get if you could cut spending when the revenue went down, that'd be one thing, but you can't. You really can't that spending.
That's true. That's true.
So you need to have a system. Now, there are things that you could do. For example, remember, wide base, low rate. You could broaden the sales tax to include services, which would make perfect sense. One of the problems that California has is that the amount of taxable retail sales. Remember, we only collect sales tax on certain things, mostly hard goods like clothes and cars and appliances. But taxable retail sales, When Jerry Brown was governor the first time around, taxable retail sales were like 60%, the equivalent of 60% of personal income. Now today, they're only about 30% or so. The sales tax was the number one source of revenue for the state of California during Jerry Brown's first governorship. Now it runs a way distant second to income taxes. So this has evolved over time. And everybody knew it was evolving. People talked about it. There were academic studies of it. There were commissions. There were all. Everybody knew that this state was becoming dangerously dependent on taxes from a handful of people, but nobody ever had the guts to say, "Hey, we got to do something about this before it gets out of hand."
It's a tough problem, yeah.
If anything, it's gotten worse, and it's continuing to get worse. And one of these days, California is going to pay the price for this when we do get a serious recession and the bottom drops out of the revenue stream. Now, Jerry will say, "Yes, but I have a rainy day fund." That rainy day fund caps out by law at $13.5 billion, and a mild recession would cost the state $20 billion a year. So it's really a kind of a drop in the bucket rainy day fund. It's not a full bucket at all. And no way you could actually have a bucket full enough to guard against that kind of a decrease. But it's one of those things. There are no villains in this. It's not that somebody did something, it's somebody didn't do something. Just like they didn't maintain the Oroville Dam, they didn't maintain the roads, they didn't maintain the tax system as well.
You know, when you say there's no villains in this, I think that's interesting because, you know, I think sometimes in your writing, it could be perceived as like, oh, you know, their crony capitalism is sort of, in, you know, has the underlying tone that people are picking winners and losers to the benefit of the winners, to the, you know, and sort of at their own personal gain as well, right? So I think in some of the, you know, in some of the verbiage, it can seem like there are, villains in this sort of, in this sort of stuff. And I think that that over time tears away at our social fabric, you know, when we lose trust in our core social institutions. You know, going back to the, you know, film, arts and entertainment, you know, tax credits. I guess I would ask you, you know, if you were to represent one of those areas and you get approached by not a movie maker, but by a grip, you know, who makes, you know, 60, 70 grand a year, if he's lucky, right? Because he's running out of jobs. He says, you know, I'm actually wrapped into this too. You know, my job depends on this. Don't you, you know, if you were, it's always easy to sort of like, when you're detached from it, to say like, well, I don't want to pick winners and losers, and we shouldn't pick winners and losers. But when people approach you, if you were in those shoes, might you not want to do something about that?
Or? Sure, you might want to do something about it, but you have to have the guts to say no sometimes. And yeah. I give Jerry Brown credit. Jerry Brown is willing to say no a lot of times.
He is, yeah.
And he didn't say no to this particular one, mind you, but he does say no sometimes. And I think you have to have the guts to say no. You have the essential problem of politics at all levels is short-term mentality, expediency, mm-hmm. getting through the day. And yes, that guy says, John, you got to do something about this because it might affect my job. And you don't want to tell him no. So you'll do a fix of some kind, some sort of gesture
yeah.
that may not save his job, but you can say, hey, I tried. No, my answer to that is...
Hey, even you can sleep better at night, but it might not actually help him. Yeah.
Or he might get you reelected. Yeah. My answer to that man would say, hey, if the jobs are moving someplace, you move to the job. That's what Americans did for many, many generations. If things weren't working out right where they were, they went to place to look for a different opportunity. We can't just guarantee everybody that they don't have to pack up and move. California was made great by people who packed up and moved here, starting in, you know, before even the gold rush, but particularly in the gold rush years and after. My cousin, Hugh Glenn, came with the Ford. He was a 49er, came from St. Louis to make a better life for himself and wound up to be the biggest farmer in California, and Glenn County is named after him.
Oh, wow.
So people did that sort of thing. He came to California, made a little money, went back to St. Louis, lost the money in a bank failure, came back to California, and became the biggest farmer in California and the 1879 Democratic candidate for governor. And people did that. My immediate family came to California from the Midwest. It's what people do. So if the grip, those jobs are going someplace, they're still making movies someplace, they're still making television shows someplace. Why doesn't that grip pack up his family and move to Georgia or wherever they're making those movies? I mean, that was rather than going running to Sacramento and saying, please give me a subsidy because my job is threatened, you know, and we have to keep this job here. And once you start down that path, I will tell you right now, for example, that the dairy industry is starting to fade in California, just like the film industry did. Should California now be giving the dairy industry a subsidy to keep it in California?
Well, there's been legislation, you know, every year for the last couple of years, right, to sort of fix a pricing discrepancy and how they get compensated for dairy that goes to cheese.
That's right? That's actually one of the least of their problems, to say yeah. the truth. But I mean, yeah, but every time you have an economic change of some kind, and remember, economic change is basically good. We don't make buggy whips anymore.
Okay.
So, but economic change is basically good. The people who become obsolete or out hustled by their competitors someplace else fade away, and that's actually a good thing. Because but the antidote to that, the solution to that is increasingly seeing, well, they have to give them a subsidy, whether it's a tax loophole or a direct subsidy or a tariff, which is now in the, you know, a tariff or some other sort of way of shielding them from economic reality. That's a slippery slope How do you then start picking who gets that kind of subsidy, who gets that prop, and who doesn't get that prop? Is it all just based on political pull, just because legislators want to have tickets to the Academy Awards, so they give them a subsidy?
I mean, let me ask you this. Should we not have bailed out the American car industries?
You know, I don't think we should have. I'm not a fan That's of rough. That. I'm not a fan of those sort of things. Detroit brought its problems onto itself.
Okay.
If you go back 100 years, back to when...
But they paid it back. They paid the money back. The government made some interest on it. But
they should have been able to get loans someplace else if they needed that. Okay. Did they need the government to step in and do that? If they had a viable industry, they could have gotten financing. They obviously thought they couldn't, or they were looking for cheaper money or something. But think about this. If you go back 100 years, back to 1918, when my mother was 2 years old, the Silicon Valley of its time was Detroit. It was where all the entrepreneurial capital was going. It's where the best engineering, most creative people were going, was Detroit. Now, they let that slip away from them. We were fat and sassy, and they didn't pay attention to business. And they let it slip away. They got beaten by competitors from Japan and Europe. And then they went running to the government and said, bail us out, bail us out, bail us out. Well, why? You know, why should we do that? Why should we? If they can't make it, why should we?
Because the guys downstream, they're going to lose their butt. You know, I mean, I think that's, I get the sense that we have, I think, different worldviews, but that's okay. Now, you know, I'm not trying to give you a hard time.
Who gets it and who doesn't?
A tough game.
Is it all by political pull? Because if it's all by political pull, that's corruption.
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure it's necessarily all by political pull, but I think ideally there's a balancing act, right? It's like, who can we attempt to help for the least amount of dollars and keep them afloat? But I mean, I think that fundamentally, I think there's this ugly thing that happens around budget season in the legislature, where and Jerry Brown talks about this too. You have infinite wants. Infinite wants, and you're sort of like, just like there's like this like parade of worthy causes that comes into the building, you know, and would talk to the staff. And you know, I was glad to take those meetings. I'm glad to connect with people, but you know, a couple of observations kind of on my way out. One is, you know, they talk to the staff, but really the budget's handled, you know, with the governor and the pro tem and the speaker and
very little of it is actually
up for grabs.
Because so much of those spending formulas I referred to, locked in spending formulas.
Yeah. Hey, because not everyone that listens to this, I've had, you know, you had Uriah Faber on last week. I had some local artists on. This is sort of a podcast for all Sacramento. And I'm going to space your episode out in a couple of weeks because the last person I had was kind of political. I don't want people to get the sense that this is simply a political show. But just to sort of, not that I don't think you're great, Dan, just to sort of contextualize this for folks, what Dan is talking about is saying, you know, 40% of the general fund budget has to go to education no matter what. And then you put in another formula, like such and such percent has to go to another cause no matter what. So am I on the right track here? The amount of money you have left, or the percentage of the total pie.
It's at the margin. Yeah. It's in a $130 or so billion general fund budget. It might be $5 or $6 billion or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 at the outside. It depends from year to year, depending on how those formulas work. But basically, it's a relatively small part of the budget is at risk. And there is this parade of people with causes. Now, just yesterday, one of the budget committees in the legislature was getting their kind of overview of the governor's budget, and we're told that, you know, you might have $12 or $13 billion that you could spend. So all the members of the committee said, well, if we're going to spend this money, then it ought to be spent here. The Republicans wanted highways and something in forestry. The Democrats wanted child care and earned income tax credit and so forth. So there's no shortage of causes and worthy projects or seemingly worthy projects to do. And you have to say what's what. Now, I do believe that some of the commitments that are seemingly locked into the budget are probably shouldn't be locked in there quite so tightly. And I think there are certain things
Prop 98, for example?
Well, what's that?
Prop 98, for example, the school funding?
Prop 98, the school funding bill, needs to be a lot simpler than it is. It's such a complicated... The guy named John Mockler, wrote that ballot measure that put in Prop 98 in 1988. John was a consultant to the California Teachers Association at the time, later had several other roles. But Mockler once joked, half seriously, that he made it so complicated that people would have to hire him to explain it to them, and therefore he could afford to put his children through Stanford University. But it's not, that was about a half a joke.
Yeah, that's not good.
But it's way too complicated, and there are only about four or five people in the whole Capitol that profess to understand what it means, and they don't agree. So, It's one of those things. It sounded like a good idea at the time. And then once it gets lodged in, nobody wants to touch it because then it becomes a kind of a third rail thing.
Yeah, yeah. At the time, it sounded like kind of like what you were talking about. Hey, let's focus on the core competencies.
Yeah.
Let's put this much money into the schools and not, you know. I think, you know, part of the problem is you can't sort of figure out what the actual Prop 98
What it does is, because the school people have this guaranteed, and they think it's inadequate, by the way, guaranteed funding every year, then the people who are out there having to scrap for their funding say, well, if they have guarantees, why can't we get a guarantee? So they'll go write a ballot measure to give themselves a guarantee. And the budget gets locked in tighter and tighter and tighter. And then when the revenues go down, there's a disaster because you can't meet all those things. And I'll give you another example of it. The governor, one of the things that Jerry Brown did is a thing called, I can't remember what they're called, but anyway, it's shifted a bunch of stuff down to local governments.
Realignment.
Shifted a bunch of things, particularly criminal public justice
safety,
stuff.
Down
to, because he was trying to empty out the prisons in relation to court orders. So you're going to put more prisoners in local jails and fewer at the state level. And they're paying these counties to do that.
Yeah.
Well, the counties didn't trust the state. So they had, they wanted,
yeah,
that,
they got their formula in place, locked
into the Constitution, so they could never be changed.
They did a good job with that. When you sort of talk about the governor, this is gonna be the longest governor and longest serving governor in state history. He's getting ready to close out.
I've been there for every minute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you've covered his tenure. And you've seen it all in the process. What does he need to do before he leaves office, in your view, to leave things in good shape for the next man or woman that comes in? Now, you already talked about sort of fixing this volatility in the funding streams, but aside from that, he's not going to do that.
He's made it pretty clear he's not going to do that.
I'd be hesitant if I were an elected official. I'd be hesitant to take a vote that can be characterized as lowering taxes on the rich to raise them on the poor.
Certainly can. That's why it's never been done.
Yeah.
But we'll pay the price for it at some point, no doubt about it. I think, since he's not willing to do that, okay, I think he's probably on the right path for the last years, was to just, look, the state's rolling in money these days because the economy's been strong, and you have these so-called temporary taxes that have kicked in and raised jillions of dollars. So the state's rolling in money, and I think he's absolutely right that to the extent possible, you need to pack that money away into reserve funds because sooner or later, the economy is going to take a header and sooner or later, the state's going to feel it. There's no way you can put away enough to truly cushion the blow. You can make it a little softer. You can't really think now. But so I think, you know, given the time he has left, that's probably about the most important thing he could do. Beyond that, there's not a lot there. He's leaving a lot of things that he started that we won't know whether they really work out till long after he's gone. The tunnels and the trains are two things, but he also has a rewrite of the state's education finance system that supposedly is supposed to help poor kids and non-English speaking kids improve their academic standing. But so far, it hasn't done much. And we really won't know whether it might all just have been a big subterfuge to pump more money into the teachers' salaries. See, but we don't know that for time being. But there are just kind of disturbing trends in that direction. So there's that. You know, so you're really asking is, what's Jerry Brown's legacy? He always claims he's not in legacy mode, but I think the reason he came back and ran for governor again was to be in legacy mode, because I think that he did not want to go into the history books as Governor Moonbeam. And there's a certain jealousy factor involving his father, and they had a very complicated relationship, as fathers and sons do.
Yeah.
And I think he wanted a better standing vis-a-vis his father and vis-a-vis other governors in the past, people like Earl Warren and whatnot. So as much as he says he's not in legacy mode, I think that was really the whole reason before he came back to the governorship, is to be in legacy mode. And will he have a good legacy? I think a lot of it's going to depend on what happens after he's gone, whether the tunnels ever get built, whether the train ever get built. Both of them are really kind of gasping for air right now. And whether the state's budget blows up and whether this school thing works out or not. The legacy won't be immediately apparent. It'll be 5-10 years from now that we'll know.
You don't, and you don't think that there's any sort of particular pieces of policy that they should pursue?
I think in his last year, it'll be very difficult to start something new. We'll find out. Now, this is being taped before his State of the State message, so we'll find out whether he even tries to do something differently. I have a hunch he's probably not going to try to do something radically different in his last year, but then that's just my guess.
Okay. Let me ask you to make a prediction here. Does he keep that official portrait?
I think he'll have a new one painted.
Yeah. I hope he keeps it.
I broke the story in the Sacramento Union.
That was your scoop?
about that choosing that painter named Don Bacardi. About choosing Don Bacardi to paint his portrait, this now infamous portrait of his that they put in the most obscure corner of the Capitol.
I like it.
I like it too. It's fine.
Kind of get concerned. A sense for a tortured young man.
I think it would be a different portrait if he has another one painted. I assume he'll have another one painted.
You think so?
I'm guessing, maybe. But yeah, I broke that story that he was having Don Bacardi do his painting, Yeah, he'll leave it there. He might have to put another one in, not to replace it, but maybe a supplement.
Yeah. Hey, so you've been covering. I'm gonna ask you to sort of just kind of take a look back, because I want to take a little bit of benefit of your wisdom, and also have you look back and forward a little bit. Okay. You've been covering California politics for, I think we said 40 years is what we said, 37 to 40 years.
More or less. 45, 40. I actually started doing it in the late 1960s off and on, but at the Capitol for 43 years.
43 years. What's the craziest story you've covered?
I think the craziest story I ever covered was the battle that went on for a year in the state assembly over a speakership, 1980. It was the craziest thing. You have Democrats trying to do in Democrats and hatreds and rivalries that exist to this day. Leo McCarthy eventually had to give up the speakership and Willie Brown became speaker.
Yep.
But the battle originally was between McCarthy and another man, Howard Berman, who later went on to be a congressman. And they went at it for a year, and it was the nastiest, lowest down, every possible dirty trick in the book thing between two factions of Democrats for control of the assembly. And it was a great story to cover, because there were so many angles of the. I mean, there were death threats.
Oh my God!
And I mean, serious stuff that went on in this thing. And in fact, the two aides to one assembly member were arrested for murder for hire in the middle of the thing.
You're joking.
No, I'm not.
Hey, can I ask you to pull this a little bit just like this? Aim it up. Yeah, there you go.
It had everything going for it.
Two aides were arrested for murder for hire.
Yeah. And they were trying
to get somebody whacked?
Not in the speakership battle, but they were arrested for murder for hire after one of them had threatened another guy who was planning to run against his boss.
Oh my God.
Threatened him with death if he ran.
Yeah.
He did run and beat the guy. But these guys were arrested for a murder for hire case for knocking off their business partner for life insurance policy.
Oh my God.
And they worked for a state assemblyman. So yeah, that was quite a deal. That was quite the thing. And it went on for a year. And created animosities and conflicts that are still going today. As we speak, there is the beginnings of a contest over who's going to be the next mayor of San Francisco.
Right.
And two of the figures in that thing are people who were part of that speakership battle and have been blood enemies ever since.
Who's that?
Willie Brown and Art Agnos.
It's like ring the bell one more round, huh?
But it's, yeah, I mean, that was probably complicated thing that, I mean, there were other things like the Shrimpgate scandal and other things, certainly, but that speakership battle was pure power politics.
Yeah. What was Willie Brown like to cover?
Willie Brown was obviously an interesting guy, but as I discovered that you went through three phases of dealing with Willie, if you were a journalist. Phase number one was charm.
Yeah, he's slick.
Okay. Phase number two was, if you didn't succumb, as it were, phase number one. Phase number two was white liberal guilt trip. You only criticize me because I'm black and you're white. You know, something like that. And in fact, I'm told that.
That can be very effective if you know, there white liberal guilt is a thing that's out there. That can, you know.
Well, that's one of the things. If you're a journalist, you have to not deal with.
Yeah. No.
I'm told that at one point George Dickmasian, who was Republican governor of California in the 80s, and Willie Brown, who was Speaker of the Assembly in the 80s. Once had a conversation in which they basically agreed that I was an asshole because I criticized them both. Duke Bacon said I was anti-Armenian. Willie said I was anti-black.
But, oh, my God.
And then the third phase with Willie is if you didn't succumb to the first two phases was that you could get along with him. All right. On the up and up. But if you did succumb either to charm or ostracization or whatever it was, then he treated you like a cipher. You didn't count anymore.
Right.
You had to stand up to him. And once you stood up to him, then you could deal with him straight up. And there was no problems after that.
Yeah.
But a lot of people didn't know that. And they tried to, he got them. Yeah. he's a piece of work. He is truly a piece of work. Brilliant man.
He got that bridge named after him. You're not supposed to name those infrastructure projects after living people.
Yeah, supposedly, right. Brilliant man. I think to this day, he's never really quite overcome a certain syndrome that I've observed in politicians, which is politicians who are born poor and derive their whole sense of identity from their political careers, have a particular problem. And you see it with, Lyndon Johnson, with, Richard Nixon, with Bill Clinton, with Willie Brown, with Jess Unruh, one of his predecessors. They can never relax because their political careers are their lives. And losing a campaign is tantamount to dying. Whereas a politician who comes from more privileged circumstances like Kennedy or a Bush, they know who they are before they ever get into politics. They don't have that sense. Their sense of identity is not totally wrapped up in their political careers. Or they're something else before they get into politics, like Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. But if they're politicians from day one and that's their whole life, it's a different kind of psychological syndrome than if you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one of the way I divide politicians between those who derive their sense of identity from politics and those who don't.
You know, I'll say this, and I tend to agree with you actually that you, you can sort of see, you know, at least for myself as a staff member, you get to know the members. You can sort of see the ones who just kind of say. Doesn't work out, I'll pack it in and
doesn't
and
work
go,
out.
I'll go. Like, you know, like Linda Halderman went back to being a doctor.
Like She's George good. Bush Sr.
Yeah.
You know, she, I lost. Okay, well, I'll go back to Kenny Bunkport, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there's others where it's just like, man, I don't know what I would do.
That's right.
You know,
and a lot of them want.
Then you can't. That I think hinders you from serving the public.
Well, what it does is it makes you susceptible to pressure,
yeah,
either internally or externally, to preserve those political careers because that's all you've got.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, was the really slick dress, like all the really slick suits and like the checkers and this, you know, the pocket squares, has that always been around in the building? You know, I just see
yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I recall Ralph Dills, for example. I don't know if you've ever known Ralph Dills. He was a lifer. He was elected to the legislature the same year Jerry Brown was born.
Yeah.
And was in the legislature and went out, became a judge and came back in the legislature. And he was a very flamboyant person. He wore white suits with white ties and diamond stick pins and had white hair.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of it reflects the fashions of the time. There was one legislator, now deceased, who used to wear these electric blue polyester suits with orange stitching on them.
Oh, my goodness.
So he was known as the polyester poet to the people inside the Capitol. I don't know. It's more of an individual thing. And then you have people like John Burton, who, you know, just slopped around. It hardly would look like he just crawled out of bed. Or John Vasconcellos the same way. I mean, it's more of an individual thing than anything else. Maybe the slickest dressers are the people who are least confident in themselves. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. You know, with the really, really slick dressed politicians in the real expensive suits, I guess.
You wonder where they get the money.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, where'd you get? One of my favorite rappers, Nelly, has this song's about drug dealing, but he has a verse and he says, "I can't believe you made that money righteously."
Yeah,
you know, it's like these public servants dressed, you know, to the nines. So I was like, God, I'm wondering where you're getting the money.
Well, of course, the slickest dresser of all was Willie Brown.
Yeah, that's why.
$1,500 suits or whatever, and he said he never wore the same tie twice or something. And
oh my goodness.
And Brioni suits. And there was when Francis Ford Coppola was making the Godfather movies.
Yeah. Right?
And it wasn't the first Godfather movie, but one of the subsequent ones. He said, we need, there was a character, a minor character, very minor character, a politician. And he said, I need a Willie Brown type. Get me Willie Brown. So Willie Brown actually flew over to Italy.
Yeah.
For a day or two, and said one or two lines, and flew back to Sacramento.
What a guy! You know, just what a remarkable life story. Hey, we're getting close to an hour, so I'll just ask you a couple more questions, if that's all right. You left the SACB to go do pretty much the same thing for Cal Matters,
right?
And I think that your shift sort of reflects a shift in the newspaper industry in general, where you know, you're in an online medium now.
Right.
And the newspaper industry is having a tougher and tougher go at it now.
Oh, well, most of my column also appears in a lot of newspapers because of the way Cal Matters distributes stuff. Yep. Yeah.
What are your sort of like, when you're looking, you look back on your career at the SACB, does the SACB go on for the next 150 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's generally true of the industry. They go on for another 150 years if they can make the transition to digital delivery.
Okay.
Number one, mainly if they can make the transition to digital delivery and make money at it.
Here's the problem, I don't want to pay.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
It's tough.
And that's it. And the industry made a huge mistake back in the 90s when it started giving away its content online. Yeah. And
because then they all had to do it.
And then they all had to not do it. And that's a very difficult thing to do. A lot of mistakes. The trouble is the newspaper industry was making so much money back in that period that it didn't really grasp what the future could be. And
almost like Detroit.
Like Detroit, very much like Detroit. Now, which raises questions. Should the state of California be giving the newspaper industry a subsidy like the movie industry to keep it in state?
That will literally never happen.
That literally will never happen. No, nor should it. Nor should it.
Not with guys like you on payroll.
That's right. I think it's a real thing. I mean, you see the shrinkage in the Capitol Press Corps.
Yeah. And they're getting younger too.
Probably the Press Corps probably is about no more than a half and maybe as little as a third of what it was. Now, I'm not talking about everybody's got a press credential, because there's a lot of people who have press credentials, but I'm talking about the working press corps that's there all the time is less than half, maybe as much, little as a third of what it once was. And
are they as competent as they once were?
I think the individuals are quite competent. In fact, they're kind of, I think, fighting, some of them are fighting above their weight. Yeah, I mean, they're producing a tremendous amount. I mean, because they're also asked to do a lot more these days: online stuff, print stuff, video, all these kind of things. I mean, I admire those people. I worked with them at the Sacramento Bee, and I know how hard they work. But the model is definitely in trouble, and whether they can make that transition and make money, enough money to support them. They don't have to make all the money in the world, because when you lose the paper, you lose maybe a third of your cost structure, the paper, the presses, the delivery mechanisms, everything. Very expensive. So, you know, you can exist on a smaller revenue base, but the question is, can you get to that point of at least breaking even on your operations without the paper, and that's the $64 trillion question. I don't know. I really don't know. And it may be that something along the Cal Matters model is the future of the news business. I mean, here we are. Cal Matters now has the largest staff of people working in the Capitol of any, more bigger than the LA Times, more than the Associated Press, more than the Sacramento Bee, which is usually the big three. Mm-hmm. We're filling, to a certain extent, that gap. Now, we're not doing the daily coverage, the in and out, the turn of the wheel, this bill passed, that one, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But we're filling the gap into the in the more,
like, value added commentary,
deeper dives, or what people in our business call thumb suckers, and that sort of thing, trying to get into the more deep detail of what's going on. And there's no doubt, for example, right now that Jessica Calfetti from CalMatters.org is doing by far the best work on K-12 education there is in California, and so on and so on and so on. And that's the model. We're oriented around issues and topics rather than the daily events and politicians' agendas.
Okay.
And it may be the only model. Now, it's not. It's a kind of juggling model. I mean, you're dependent on people being willing to pay for it, or donors willing to donate to a nonprofit organization. But it's worked in other states. Texas Tribune, for example, is about three times as big as Cal Matters. It's worked in Texas. It's worked in other places, and we think it can work here. And so far, it has worked here. You know, while other people are shedding staff in the Capitol, we're adding.
Right.
And we just hired a higher education writer, for example. And so it's there. We hope it keeps going. It's certainly needed. You need, when a state as complicated as California, and as important as California is, needs to have solid journalism attached to it, and I think Cal Matters is filling that role right at the moment. Not that people at the LA Times or the Associated Press or the Sacramento Bee are not doing bad work. They are, but they're getting stretched thinner and thinner and thinner.
Yeah,
and you can't keep stretching at something without something giving eventually.
You covered Daryl Steinberg as a pro temp,
right?
He is now,
as an assemblyman as well.
And as an assemblyman. He's now a mayor.
Right.
How's he doing?
I think it's too early to tell how he's doing. He's certainly ambitious, and Daryl's one of those people, kind of like Willie Brown, that thinks he can fix anything. He can make any kind of deal that needs to be made, particularly when it comes to mediating and dealing making. He's kind of in the Willie Brown mode. He thinks he can do any deal. And he's been very successful at it. I think, however, that the test on Daryl will be whether he can deal with some of the city's more fundamental issues. Homelessness, for example, which is a tough nut to crack for anybody.
Right.
And the thing lurking, the 800-pound gorilla that's lurking in the background, not only for Sacramento, but every city in California. I just finished doing a long piece on it.
It's pensions.
At this moment, has pensions. Pension costs that are just going out of sight. If you look at the data on Sacramento, for example, you see double or tripling their pension burden in the not too distant future, and which leads politicians and may lead Mayor Steinberg into seeking new taxes, saying it's going to pay for this, that, and the other.
It really goes to the...
When it really will happen is you'll pay for this, that, and the other that used to be paid in the city's general fund. You'll take that money out, free up that money to pay for the pension cost. Because the pensions are the 800-pound gorilla that's eating city government in California. Cities more than counties or anybody else, because cities have their high payroll vis-a-vis their budget, number one, and it's high paid, highly benefited payroll, police and fire particularly, and there's where the real increases are coming. It's commonly in California now, cities are paying 50% of payroll for their police and close to that for their firemen. The expectation is that they're going to go up to 75, 80, and maybe 100% of payroll in the not too distant future.
Right.
And this is going to kill cities. We have seen three cities go into bankruptcy. And in part because of these pension costs already. And there are others that are headed that way. And city officials are very frank about it, that's they see that as happening to them because they can't deal with what's going on.
Last question for you. Your view on the state of American politics today and how polarized we are?
Well, we're very polarized. And
do you feel like this has been sort of bubbling in the background for a long time and we finally...
Yeah, it has been bubbling. I mean, the two parties have been in this constant search for identity. And over time, they've even switched positions from time to time. And geographically have switched positions. We've seen the South become Republican. It used to be solidly Democrat. We've seen the Upper Midwest become Democrat. It used to be solidly Republican. Now it may be going back to Republican again. New England used to be solidly Republican. Now it's solidly Democrat. California was solidly Republican a couple of decades ago.
Yeah, 30 years ago.
And now has become solidly Democrat. And we have seen within that, we've also seen rifts within the parties, particularly in areas where they're dominant. So Democrats in California or Republicans in Alabama start breaking into these sub-factions, quasi-parties. Nature abhors a vacuum. And if you don't have two-party competition, then you have intra-party competition. And you're like, seeing that in the Democratic Party in California 16, right now.
Between the Bernie bros and the Hillary
and
people.
And so all of this is, it's not so much polarization in the usual sense of the word Democrat versus Republican. It's polarization. It's more cultural polarization that's then reflected in the politics of the country and of the state. Maybe it's inevitable. Maybe it's just, it comes with diversity, perhaps. When this nation was founded, excluding black slaves who should not have been excluded, the people who founded this nation were white male landowners who had a similar, they may have disagreed on some things, but they basically had a similar worldview. So they had a sense of consensus on that. Now we are a country of dozens, hundreds of languages and ethnicities and cultural backgrounds and races. And it's hard to find that consensus. And California, which is by far the most diverse of all the states, has that problem in spades more than most states. We are, it's difficult to find consensus on any issue. And when you then throw into the mix the form of government that we have, this multi-branched sort of government, where all the branches have to kind of be in agreement and both houses of the legislative branch have to be in agreement. And you have to it becomes very difficult to make public policy when you basically need unanimity.
Right.
But you can't even get consensus.
Right.
And it makes it, and it explains why so many of our issues, to harken back to something we talked about earlier, say highway maintenance, for example, goes on year after year without being resolved. Or tax reform goes on year after year without being resolved, because you really can't ever get that kind of cultural and social consensus that you need then to have a political consensus. Politics is not a leading edge occupation. It's a trailing edge occupation. It deals with what goes on in society after the fact. It is the people at the end of the parade with scoop shovels, not the people out there in front of the parade with the batons. And if you don't have the kind of consensus over what should be done, at least general consensus, then politics breaks down. It can't really function very well. And that's why we don't see it function very well. Now, most recently, of course, we've had a one-party state. So both houses of legislature, the governor, and they're all kind of, so they can say, well, look, we're doing things in California because we're, you know, but that's because it's a one-party state, which is the antithesis of democracy when you think about it. And eventually what will happen, and it is happening already, is that one party will then start breaking up into factions, and you will no longer have a one-party state. You'll have a multi-party state. They may all call themselves Democrats, but in fact, they're going to be multiple parties.
Yeah. You know, let me tell you something about that one-party thing. It's one party, but it's tough to get legislation through. You know, you know, as a staffer sort of who's tasked with, you know, with running bills, you know, you just take all the Republicans and put them on the no column because they're not going to vote for, they're not going to vote for anything. Okay. So you got to get the 21 votes in the Senate and you got, you know, maybe 24, 25 senators. And then, you know, you can just look up because it's probably a bill reintroduction, right? You can just look up the guys who voted yes and no on this last time.
Right.
And you realize like you've got a margin, like after it's all said and done, you've got a margin of like two senators left to play. Right. You know what I mean?
That's why little groups like the Mod Squad in the assembly can have a lot of power.
Disproportionately powerful. Yeah. Because that's, you know, once you start, you know, in the assembly.
But too, that's what 58. Happens when you get a one party state. You start breaking up into these.
Yeah. I guess all I'm saying is like those, it's not a monolith. You know, it's, no, it's there's, not a, there's a spectrum of beliefs in that caucus.
Yeah, there is. And that's a natural state because one party can't really deal with the complexity of an entire state. Yeah. So you have to break up into these factions defined by geography, by ideology, by ethnicity, by whatever. And that inevitably happens. It happens in San Francisco among the Democrats, but it's kind of a one-party state. It happened among Republicans in Orange County because it was a one-party state, one-party county at one time. You see that sort of thing go on all the time. Nature abhors a vacuum. You can't force people to march in lockstep. They'll find reasons to disagree. But back to the legislative process. The legislative process is essentially a negative process. You have X number of hurdles, 7 or 8 hurdles you have to get through. Committee votes, floor votes, you know,
appropriations, final votes,
all these things you got to go through, right?
And then in the other house.
You can't not cover one hurdle. You have to get through all of the hurdles, and every hurdle then is a way for the people who don't like the legislation for one reason or another to stop it from happening.
Yeah, it's designed to stop. It's designed to stop.
It's a negative process.
Yeah.
It's essentially a negative process. It was designed to be a negative process.
Yeah.
It was designed by the founding fathers to be a negative process because they were suspicious of power. So they just got filed a revolution to get off of a despotic king. And they were suspicious of power. So they wanted to distribute power wider, to disperse it among several different branches and all sorts of procedural things to make it difficult to get something through. Now, if you're a lobbyist in Sacramento, what you really want to be as a lobbyist is the stopper. You don't want to be an advocate. You want to be a stopper because the stopper has a much easier job of it than the advocate. And people.
I remember a lot. Let me stop you here. I remember a lobbyist who, you know, I'll just forget the names to protect the innocent, right? I'll just say,
sure.
But she was a stopper. Her job was to stop things that were bad for business, and a business district from my boss's district had them on retainer. Hey, we need you to do some legislation for us permitting us to do the following, you know, X. Let's just keep it hypothetical. And, you know, for the first time really, like I think in her career, she had to advocate and she had to posit a solution, you know, like work with policy staff.
Didn't know how to do it, right?
She was like, I have literally no idea. She's like, this is 10 times harder. I was
it is 10 times harder.
You know, like they're man, as you see these lobbyists, man, they're just like the vultures circling the carcass. It's like, how are we going to stop you? You know?
And you know, I mean, it's not unknown. I don't know if it still goes on, but it's not been unknown in the past that lobbyists would, if they felt that one of their clients was a little shaky in terms of re-upping, they would have legislation
introduced
to hurt their client so they could claim credit for stopping it. It's been known to happen. Yeah. One of the funniest experiences I ever had is that, I can't remember the exact details, but it had to do with the distribution of state money for parks. And this one city in Southern California did not get an allocation of money. So the lobbyist for that city wrote a memo to the city saying that the reason they didn't get the allocation was that the allocation was only going to go to minority-dominated cities and those cities that were white population cities.
Oh, my goodness.
And that memo got boomeranged back to me from a city councilman or somebody saying, this is outrageous that we're being discriminated against because we're a white city. So I called up the lobbyist who I'd known for many years. He was one of the real veterans in there. And I said, how about this? And there's this silence on the other end of the line. And he said, I've made that up. I had to explain why we couldn't get the money. And I just
made that up.
He said, you going to burn me? I said, I should burn you.
Yeah.
But to me, the story was the city being discriminated against if it was white.
Yeah.
It was a white city.
You have to throw your buddy under the bus.
The fact that you did this is basically inside baseball. However, you owe me.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, so do you...
Which is by way of saying some of the most creative lobbying is done by the lobbyists on their clients.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I always thought that was interesting. You're handling politics in two ways, right? Especially these like association lobbyists. You've got to shore up the position within the association and deal with the internal politics, uh-huh. and then pretend to have a unified front, you know, over in the building. It's kind of like... You're kind of like surrounded and you're fighting. And
contract fronts, lobbyists, you know, have the best of it because they have multiple candidates. I know of a lobbyist who fired his biggest client one time because they said they were basically a pain in the ass. He went to their annual meeting and said, I fire you. I don't want to represent you anymore. You're a pain in the ass. But and I've seen instances where lobbyists were paid $50,000 for one day's work.
Yeah.
Just to turn one legislator against a bill, you know, or something like that. I mean, yeah. There are a lot of tricks in the trick. I actually wrote a book about lobbying one time.
Oh, yeah.
With a retired lobbyist about almost 20 years ago. I wrote a book called The Third House, Lobbyist Money and Power in Sacramento. Yeah.
And that's a book that's issued to you by the Sacramento State Department of
Political Science. Who wins and who loses in Sacramento and why.
Yeah.
And all the techniques of lobbying and how it was basically what happened was this lobbyist wanted to write a book about lobbying. And I wanted to write a book about the legislature and how it had evolved with term limits and one thing or another. So we wound up writing this book about how lobbying worked and how it has evolved as the legislature has evolved. So it was kind of a hybrid book in a way. So I satisfied me and satisfied him. But I think it's still mostly valid.
That template is the same, right? Like the template of power politics and the template of influencing votes. I mean, I think that the industry of politics, of legislative politics, will evolve in terms of social media and how we reach out to constituents and how we become more inclusive to minority communities. I think that's really like where it's going to change. But I think like the basic art of, you know, the acquisition, application, and retention of power is timeless.
The lobbying techniques have evolved, though. Term limits made a big difference in lobbying techniques.
That's fair.
And it evolved because it weakened legislative leadership. So lobbyists were, rather than running through the leadership was choosing candidates, basically, running. The lobbies or the interest groups started doing the same thing. Because once you had term limits, then you knew when a vacancy would occur.
Right.
And you could start grooming people
to take that seat.
For school board seats or city council seats to take that legislative seat. So the real creative lobbyists, like we go into that in the book, started looking back at the grassroots because they had to get people
ready.
And kind of legislative leadership wasn't doing that anymore because it couldn't do it anymore with term limits. Now, term limits have been modified again, and I think you've seen the reemergence of legislative leadership to a certain extent with that. But lobbying techniques do change. They evolve from time to time, and more interestingly, I think, or just as interestingly, who has power in the Capitol has evolved greatly over time. when I came to the Capitol in 1975, the big interests were horse racing, insurance companies, banks were the big guys in the Capitol.
I don't think I met a horse racing lobbyist in my time there.
They were huge at one time. And now, and the health industry and all its manifestations is probably, and the public employee union. So neither of them were big in 1975. And now they are the biggest.
Yeah.
So things have evolved over time as to who wields power and who doesn't wield power. Kind of in lockstep to a certain extent with the economy. Healthcare emerging now as the state's largest single economic activity, by far the largest, has made it now a powerful force in the Capitol. Not that it's a monolith. It's very definitely not a monolith. But it's a preoccupying issue in the Capitol is the delivery financing of healthcare, because it's close to a $300 billion a year industry in California right now.
Yeah. Hey, last question for you. Actually, you know, I'll take a minute here and tell you. You were talking about the back when the newspapers had money. Mm-hmm. You know who would tell me stories about this was, I don't know if you know Aurelio Rojas.
Yeah, I know Aurelio.
Yeah, he just had the wildest stories about lavish spending in the newspaper days back when they had money. He'd always start his stories with like, "Oh, this is, you got to understand, this is back when the newspapers had money."
Well, I remember when Jim Copley owned the papers in San Diego, his people all flew first class everywhere they went. So you'd have the candidates and the rest of the press corps in the back of the plane, but the San Diego Union people would be in the front of the plane in first class.
Man, isn't that something?
And lavish expense accounts and spending like crazy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember there was one reporter for the San Diego Union who was such a spender, she got the name Million Dollar Margaret because she... She ran up these enormous hotel bills and restaurant bills and everything.
Oh, my God. Yeah, far cry from where we are today. With, with that arc in mind, would you still advise people into the journalistic profession to seek it out?
I think there will always be journalism. I think that there is an appetite for content. The question is how you deliver it and how you get paid for it. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I would say yes, but... You have to be able to do more than just type on a keyboard.
Okay.
You need to do video. You need to do other things. You need to be
social.
More adept at new techniques of conveying information. It's a transition for me to deal with a guy who went to work in the newspaper business when there was linotype machines and old big Underwood upright typewriters, literally.
Wow.
Typing on copy sets on scraps of paper and editing with a pencil to go to the age that we are in now.
And you just type it up. Yeah.
So it's better. I like the idea. The technology has certainly become better. But I think there's always going to be a market. It's going to be tough. It's not going to just be newspapers like it once was. It's going to be a lot of things like CalMatters or like freelancing, but it's always going to have a societal demand for information.
Okay.
And it should be a demand for good information and not fake news, by the way. But recognize the difficulty of it. I think it's a noble calling, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Final thoughts for you. Hey, where can folks find you on Twitter?
Twitter. I can't remember. At Walders CalMatters, I think it is.
Okay. We'll flash it up on the screen as well. Thanks for coming by. That's been episode number 16.
Or maybe it's Dan CalMatters. I can't remember.
That's okay. We'll put it up on the screen.
Whatever it is.